Kia ora and welcome to System Fix, a podcast from the health media. My name is Barbara Fountain, editor of New Zealand Doctor, writer Aotearoa. In this podcast, we are going to try and follow the progress in fixing New Zealand's health and disability services system following the release of the Simpson Report. I'll be joined by regular panellists and guests to discuss what's up with the changes and take a look at what can be learnt from past restructuring. This episode, we are looking at what the changes might hold for disability services. I am joined by Ruth Jones and Jane Cartwright, both zooming in from Christchurch. Kia ora.
Kia ora.
Welcome, guys. Can we just start with some introductions and explain what your background is and what your interest is in these current reforms? Ruth.
Kia ora koutou, ngā mihi nui ki a koutou katoa. Tū mai rā, mangu hikurangi, e riri atu rā ki te awa o Waiapu, nei rā parairangi e mihi atu nei. Kia ora, my name is Ruth Jones, thank you for having me. I'm a disabled Māori woman and I sit in the whānau ora space. My husband and I have a whānau ora entity called Hei Whakapiki Māori, and whānau ora is where I'm really happiest. I say that because I think that in terms of what we're going to be talking about today, I think that whānau ora is life-affirming and raises the Māori of who we support and who I am. I trained as a social worker many years ago and have been a manager in the disability sector and now a consultant in the disability sector and have a whānau ora service.
Thanks. And Jane?
Oh, good morning. Morena. So wearing the hat today as a chair of one of New Zealand's largest disability providers for people with significant intellectual disabilities, having had a long history of working in health and disability services, with some pretty unpleasant experiences working at the old Templeton Centre and through some of the days of the deinstitutionalisation of Sunnyside Hospital. And so I've got a passion for putting people at the centre of what we do, recognising the needs of them and their families, and would like to think that disability services would meet the needs of our population much better. But more importantly, I do see it as a significant equity issue for a significant proportion of our population.
Thanks, Jane. So I'm just going to start with a little bit of a recap where we're actually at with the reforms to date, or I actually prefer to call them the changes, because reform does imply that we're going to get something better. We hope to get something better, but let's stick with the health changes. Currently, we have a transition unit set up, which is being headed by Steve McKernan, who's a management consultant from EY. Of course, Stephen was previously a director general and has also spent a short period as an acting director general. That unit is sitting within the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet. It is yet to get an advisory board which will advise on the recommendations from the report which are going to go ahead, but it has been holding meetings with groups out in the sector. Just looking at the report itself, and I'm going to confess that last night as I was stuck in traffic in Auckland here, I actually checked out the audio version of the report and listened to the recommendations, which was actually quite a different experience from kind of quickly flicking through the pages and looking for keywords. So the key points that I followed up on were $1.4 billion of funding for disability services comes from the Ministry of Health, $1.4 billion from DHBs. Higher rates of disability are found in families living in high deprivation. Māori have significantly higher rates over all age bands. People over 65 have higher rates than other age bands. The report has got an incredibly strong focus on trying to improve outcomes for Māori, that we want a health system that provides equitable outcomes, and it's also a health system that is sustainable into the future. So Jane, can I just start with you? In terms of where we're at with disability services at the moment, can you just explain to our listeners a little bit about the structure, and then we'll talk about how these proposed changes might impact on that.
Well, in recognition of Ruth's lived experience of this, what I see, if I think about the people who need services, is that we've moved from quite a substantive institutional model to a model that was in the community, to now a model whereby people with disabilities actually have a voice and they want to have a voice, and they are reasonably well mobilised and expressing their voice. And what I see is that they don't see themselves as receivers of the health system as their only way of doing things. I'm interested in the figures they put in the report, because a substantive amount of support will be provided for people with disabilities through what would have been the old MSD and MB, because actually people with disabilities live in the community, and just like you and I, they need health services. They don't live in the health services, and that's been a historic thing. And I think in terms of the report, if I jump to now, part of the problem is that the report doesn't recognise that. Ruth, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's very little evidence in people with a lived experience of disabilities and or their families, recognising some people, particularly in the world in which I work, are non-verbal, who've been involved in the creation of the HDR. Their voices are absent. We don't see move forward to the last sort of 10 years in development in terms of people-centred and people-driven disability services, any recognition of the enabling good lives and the transformation of the disability sector. We did see that. We would see that, in fact, the call from the disability sector is probably to establish like a Ministry of Disability or a Disability Commission, which actually thinks about people with disabilities as people, not as, to be frank, patients. They're not patients. They may need special things within the health service, but they're not patients. And part of that challenge has been, and what I think is a problem with the HDR, is that the HDR, in my view, is leaned to structural reform. It's great around some of the public health and equity stuff. But what I don't believe it does is it doesn't align the thinking of the disability sector with the patient-focused focus of the health system. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah. I should just point out to our listeners that when we talk about HDR, Health and Disability Report, that is the Simpson report that we also kind of call the Simpson report. So Ruth, one thing when I talked with you yesterday before we got started, you mentioned the Enabling Good Lives. And I have to confess right up front that I am the editor of a medical newspaper and our focus has always been on the health sector. And we do cover disability services to one side, but kind of a bit like the health sector itself, we do kind of put it to one side. And so when you talked about Enabling Good Lives, I flicked through and went and looked into what that was about. And the report has come back and said the system needs to support the principles of Enabling Good Lives. Can you just go through for our listeners what Enabling Good Lives covers?
So when we talk about this, the transformation of the disability system, it is about disabled people having more choice and control. It's about organising the funding so that the resource is closer to us and is based on our aspirations rather than just our needs. Disabled people need the same equitable health outcomes as non-disabled people, but disabled people need supports to lead a good life, and those disability supports are different, and those things need to be separated. It is called Enabling Good Lives. It's the transformation of the disability system.
But the health system is not really the best place to provide that support for people to lead good lives. We would want to probably more insurance-type model. As part of the transformation, it requires a whole different way of operating at a government level and at an organisational level to achieve that, because you have to treat people as individuals and not as part of an institution where you would bulk fund them, for example.
Really, what both you're saying to me, I just kind of wonder if, A, the Simpson report, for a start, hasn't actually engaged with the disability community sufficiently. So if that's the case, it's kind of flawed from the start with regard to the recommendations it might have for the sector. So you're both nodding your heads.
I think it's a lost opportunity. I wouldn't say in their defence, but let's recognise 1 in 5 people in New Zealand have a disability. Those people have a more physical disability. I won't say easier to deal with, but it's a more obvious sort of situation. People with complex behavioural issues like what we deal with, or really complex physical and clinical needs, which bearing my head at Brackenridge we also deal with, you know, their needs are very challenging and require a multi-sector approach. And you know, that I think that they don't just think about the full gambit of disability. And then the other thing that I would throw in the conversation, and we know that I think it's Geoffrey Palmer's been very active in this space, is that if you inherit a disability through an ACC type event versus an illness event, you are treated very differently by the system. But it doesn't mean that your aspirations or health needs are any different. And that's another form of inequity which we've created in a structural sense, irrespective of the other things which lead to inequity.
So given the recommendations, and I must say, when I mentioned earlier that I'd listened to the audio of the recommendations, and I did feel like with the disability recommendations, they felt rather aspirational, like we will engage more with disability community, whereas with health side, it's been more, this is what we're going to change. For disability services, for people who aren't actually engaging with health, why would you put them under the health umbrella?
You wouldn't.
It's easy. People want to organise people to be there in the easiest possible way for the system.
Oh, I see. It's easy for the system.
It's easy. Absolutely.
Right.
And it's easier to control. It's easier to maintain status quo.
So it must be a few years ago that we actually changed the legislation. Jane, do you recall which series of reforms that happened under?
We're talking about, you know, probably 60 plus years of this concept where making people safe, which Ruth has alluded to, so particularly people with things which society didn't tolerate, didn't understand or didn't have the capacity to deal with, we locked people away. And at that stage, you did have a different disabilities type government. And through some of the Gibbs reforms in the sort of 80s, things got changed there into area health boards and pulled together. That's when some of the big institutions, mental health, intellectual disability, got pulled in. And where the training for health professionals changed as well, because we used to train psychopaedic nurses and psychiatric nurses differently. So I'm talking sort of 70s and 80s. And then at that stage, disability was pulled into the ministry and has been through various machinations. One positive thing, although I think it's still a challenge in the latest set of health reforms, is that the disability sector is now at a tier two within the ministry. But that probably, COVID aside, has not delivered the focus that the disability sector believed it would in terms of engagement with them about what the best thing to do was. We're trialling this Enabling Good Lives in a number of communities, and you also have now 99.9% of disability services provided outside the DHB realm, and the majority of them are funded externally through the ministry directly. So there's another challenge with the HDR is that the devolution of disability services into a, at best, illness / wellness model is not the right place to put things. And many of the organisations who work in the disability sector are national organisations who have a very different philosophy in terms of supporting people to have the best life possible.
If we look at the historical context, I mean, the reason why disability and health has always been together is that it's assumed that we need to get fixed. Jane's explained that trajectory really well. And the assumption is we're not okay as we are. We needed to become well. And obviously in the health system, people did hopefully become well, but that the same assumption has been made for us. So as long as I remember, that has always been the case, you know, in terms of that old traditional way of looking at disability. It certainly has changed. I mean, I think we've gone from we very often sit in the medical model a few years ago, you know, and that goes with the charity model. So all of those models are deficit based. And I think we need to, as Jane said, and as hopefully the report recommends the Māori, the health authority, we also need something like that. Us to not just have our voices heard, be equitable in the system and work in the system. I'm tired and tired and tired of the consultation. So I think we can have lots of consultation with disabled people and engage with disabled people, as you were saying, in terms of the recommendations. But we need to partner with disabled people for any systemic change.
And it's also, too, giving voice to the fact New Zealand is a party to the UN Declaration on People with Disability. And we have some very prominent New Zealanders involved in that work who, you know, are leading some of this thinking. So, you know, I think there is a platform there to think about doing this differently.
So, Ruth, if the transition unit came to you tomorrow and said, what would you like to see changed about the recommendations? Because the recommendations are recommendations, and my understanding is that it's still up to presumably someone within the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet or this advisory board to actually sign off on what will ultimately happen. I mean, it's pretty clear that we are going to get fewer DHBs and there's going to be changes in primary care services and tier one services, but it's not at all clear what might happen in the disability sector, partly because the recommendations are, as I say, operational. If they came to you and said, okay, Ruth, how would you like to see us restructure?
Evolving systems transformation. So they want to make sure that disability support and good outcomes in terms of health for people with disabilities are really separated. So okay. I think, and so what I would say to them is to keep disability support services well away from the DHB.
Absolutely.
That's the biggest thing. We don't want to go back to that system. I know that a few services are funded by the DHB, which is okay, but I think that we need to have a very clear distinction between what is disability support when we are well, and 99% of the time we are well, and what is good healthcare for us. And those things are separate and need to be equally considered. But I think the majority of time we're well, we're working, we're having families, we're doing the stuff that everybody else does. And we needed to be supported to do that. And the DHB is not the place, as Jane said, for that to happen.
Okay. So under the new kind of structure, would they still intent on keeping disability services within the health umbrella, would you see maybe Health NZ contracting directly with the national disability groups to provide services that way?
I don't have enough knowledge on that stuff. I want to make sure that disability is out of health. That's my only focus. It can't be in health. It can't sit in health because we will never get the outcomes we need.
So that would imply we need to create a new government agency specifically for disability services?
Yeah, I'm looking at Jane for confirmation.
That's our aspiration. Because remember, health is only one of the partners. By far of equal volume is the stuff that comes from MSD in terms of disability support or MB. There's two things about the future and doing what Ruth is suggesting. It would allow us to actually put in place that social insurance model, which allows people to aspire to what they want and get the right supports around them, whether they choose to organise those themselves through their families or through another entity. And so I'm putting my bureaucratic hat on. It's a whole different funding structure because you're actually funding people by the day, by the activity. And so it's a very high volume, low value system, which DHBs are not set up to do. Mm. They're not set up to run this sort of personalised funding. And the other thing it will demonstrate, which is another reason to take out of health, is that disability services currently are significantly underfunded. The information tells us only about 75% of what it costs, and that's why there's a big hole in the Ministry of Health. But the other thing is that when we do move to a model which allows people with disability to live the lives that they aspire to with appropriate supports and receive the healthcare they want, then it will be significantly more expensive. And that's not a reason not to do it. It's a bit like what we learned when we deinstitutionalised mental health. It is much easier to put people in an institution and give them breakfast at 8, give them lunch at 1 o'clock and dinner at 10 and put them to bed at 8 o'clock at night and treat them as a bulk fund. The minute you move to individualised funding, you have to think about the individual. And so you have to fund by the individual, and it is more expensive. That's not the reason not to do it. Actually, you get better outcomes for people.
And I think you put the funding in different places.
Yeah, you do.
So with people with individualised funding, it's been proved that we don't use all the funding.
Yeah.
We are really responsible fund holders ourselves if we do have that responsibility.
Yeah. So earlier on, I think when I asked about why they're going this way, you said that possibly it was because it was the easy option. But when you spell it out, the idea that DHBs would take on this responsibility doesn't sound like an easy option at all for them.
So. They're not set up to do it. I mean, it's not that people don't care. I mean, the organisation I chair, our shareholder, is the DHB. But they have very little to do with us in terms of day-to-day operations. We have to run our whole systems differently, given that we've got people who are bulk funded, people who are individualised funding packages, people who are enabling good lives. The whole infrastructure that sits in behind it is different. And then if I can just divert you for a minute, the things that people with intellectual disability need to make them have and support good lives are often very domestic in style. And so a lot of the reason institutions struggled in the past was because they were competing with big shiny hospitals who needed new MRI machines or needed this, that, and the next thing. Actually, what I really need is actually three new vans that all take wheelchairs, very low cost in comparison. And so you don't use the same language. Now, DHBs are not good at running those things which are domestic often in their look because their thinking's not in that space. I'm not being dismissive of the fact they don't care, but it's not their priority.
So if they pursue going down this route, I mean, they're potentially setting up the DHBs to continue failing in this area.
I think they are. They're giving them work that's not their core business. The word fail is a bit strong, but they will not succeed because it's not part of what their core business is.
And as a disabled person, I want the DHB to concentrate on really good hospital care if I need surgery and nurses that know about disability and doctors that have more than a couple of days training in disability. So if your DHB wants to get really skilled in this work, then let the healthcare be the focus.
That's right. Yeah, make sure that you get good community services. Ruth probably doesn't want them organising her support workers to come three times a day. You know, I think the things that you do.
That's right.
Your systems.
But I do want them, and what they assumed. I mean, it's really interesting when I had a hip operation, and I do think this is relevant. Is that the next day, once I had a hip replacement, they wanted me to get out of bed and walk. Now I don't walk. I don't want to walk. The hip operation was to reduce pain. their assumption, because they saw me as a patient that needed to be fixed, is that I could get up and walk. And so I fell on the floor and they needed to reoperate. And so that stuff needs to get really, really good now. It needs to be unbuttoned and done again.
And, you know, Ruth and other people with disabilities want a general practice that actually makes sure that all the screening things that they're entitled to happen.
Yeah.
They want a building that you can get in the door and you can get in their waiting room. They want access to dental services where, you know, the dental chair is appropriate for someone with a disability to sit in so that they can have their teeth done, because people with disabilities often have really bad teeth because of the diets that often they have to eat because of swallowing and other type functions. So these are the things that the health system could really do much better at rather than trying to control people with disabilities' lives.
You mentioned before MSD is also involved quite significantly in support for people with disability. Is there another better fit other than starting a new agency? If it's preferable not to have disability support sitting in health, is there somewhere else you'd rather see it?
You know, if they started final order and they did it well and it was legislated, this needs to be legislated and done well.
You need an organisation that has the right philosophy right from the top. It wouldn't mean that they don't work with education and they don't work with MSD and all those other services that support people with disability, but it would start with the right philosophy at the top rather than being just another add-on to MB or something like that.
Has this been included in the policy of any political party in the last 10 years?
It's been a constant theme in a lot of advice to ministers over the last 10 years that I've been more intimately involved.
I think the cabinet paper for Enabling Good Lives is the pre-papers have gone up to ministers. The cabinet paper will be up with a budget bid by February or March next year. I think we need to get EGL across the line.
It's EGL, Enabling Good Lives. How long has that model been in development?
Since 2011. And again, and I keep on talking about whānau ora because it was, you know, the then Minister, Tariana Turia, now Whaia, Tariana Turia, was really clear that when she started whānau ora, that EGL was a similar model for disabled people, because she knew that focusing on disabled people and families would work as whānau ora has done. And knowing, I suppose, knowing that disabled people, and I know we disabled people have lots of challenges and all the rest of it, but knowing that if we're given the resource and if families are given the right support, we are hugely resilient. And she assumed that Māori were hugely resilient in whānau ora, and she wanted that same assumption to be made about disabled people.
So as the reforms being worked on now, is there any forum that you can see where you can advance this argument?
Oh, there's lots of forums. There's there's the governance groups within Enabling Good Lives. There are the DPO, the Disabled Persons Coalition. But I think again, these groups need to be resourced and listened to, you know, and really understood and worked with. And forums are there, and consultation happens. But I look forward to the day when we go beyond consultation to where we're true partnerships. And that can only happen, and I keep on returning to this, but that can only happen if there's a really good framework for partnership to happen. And a good framework for me is a treaty framework. Unless Enabling Good Lives has a treaty framework, and unless the Simpson Report considers a treaty really seriously, and I think they are, you know, that's a partnership model that we've always had in New Zealand that can ensure that Māori, but also disabled people, have equitable outcomes.
Current Minister was challenged on the time frame for the rollout of the Simpson Report, and I think originally it said over the next 5 years, and he's actually committed to rolling out the merger of the DHBs a lot sooner. But there is an argument that pushing these things through just to meet a time frame is not necessarily the best way to go if we don't actually have the correct model in place. I mean, if we talk about this as the opportunity of a lifetime, we have seen a framework which vaguely shows the primary care sector is going to be the first sector that kind of gets significant change coming through. Would you like to see the disability aspect of the recommendations put not on hold, but given time to actually develop better recommendations rather than pushing them through to get the reforms done?
And the recommendations in the report are fairly high levels. That we need to have the whole on the disability ones, because then I don't think they understand it, that they haven't engaged, and there will be enormous pushback from the disability sector. I do have a personal view, I don't know what Ruth thinks, the disability sector has a voice. The genie's out of the box. They are now hanging on to a better life. We can see that through some of the discussions we've had around funding families to look after people. We'll see it through the enabling good lives relationships. And it's probably a discriminatory thing to say, but the HDR will move on DHB reform, it'll move on primary care reform, and disability will be left to the bottom. And that's just quite normal. You know? So at one level, things may not change because it's just all too difficult. But if they were to move away from the system transformation, then the disability sector, both providers and members of the disability sector, would fight that quite actively. Because there's a sense that we're on the cusp of actually something which is so much better for people. And there's a clarity of that message, which, as Ruth says, let the health system do a good thing to support people with disability to access good, safe services to keep them well or to manage their health, and let them, people with disabilities, work out how to live a good life, whatever that might be for them within the broader community. I also believe the community are a bit more accepting of people with disabilities. We've had 20 years of kids being mainstreamed at school, not locked away at the age of three, like they were at Templeton. Ruth and Gary have experience of that, have been segregated from society. That's not happening, so there's a big momentum out there. But there are a lot of people hurting because they're struggling, because it's not given enough support financially or in kind.
And I think I've got the attitude that I have, or the perspective at the end of the year, just before Christmas, because we're working with Māori families who don't trust any system. And so those families, they don't trust the health system, they don't trust the education system. They've been, you know, disadvantaged the whole time. So I'm also looking at ways where people can understand what's happening. And at the moment, Hei Whakapiki Māori is needing to translate that information because families don't get it. And families are really, absolutely, as Jane said, some families are really hot on enabling good lives and leading the change and things. And some families are just really tired. You know, so, and poor, and so, you know, there's a whole lot of stuff that needs to be sorted for disabled people and families to really get a grip on what's happening. Because what I'm afraid of is that the changes will happen, and because they haven't built the capacity of the community, even though the community is changing, we'll be running to catch up. Pacifica whānau, Māori whānau, whānau who have low economic status around New Zealand, those families are just struggling for day to day. So they can't even lift themselves up to think about what a good life might be for them, let alone their children. Could be a good system, but people really need to include everybody. And at the moment, Enabling Good Lives has not even got Pacific on the radar.
And I think about what I'd say is, I was talking to Stephen McKinn, I think that's a leap of faith. We have to trust the disability sector. Actually, they do know, by and large, what they need and what they want. And with good government support, good financial support, they could, you know, really deliver some fantastic outcomes for people and society generally. But it is a leap of faith, and they've got to get past it. You have to keep people safe. What does safe mean? Safe doesn't mean being locked up or constrained to a very set way of living.
Safe means being loved and cared for, and the ability to love someone else. And I think to not be passive recipients of service, we need to be able to contribute and have some reciprocity. And I think that we're up for that.
Given the right support, we could do quite fantastic things.
Well, I think we've covered quite a lot today, and I'm going to continue coming back to disability because, like you say, I think even though there's the issue maybe that everything gets rushed to get implemented, Jane pointed out that often disability just gets left behind anyway, so maybe we need to worry about the rush, but we will be back. So typically, to kind of close off our podcast, we've got a bit of a quiz, a pop quiz for you guys. You don't have buzzers, so when you're going to answer the question, you just go, me. Right. According to the Simpson Report, three areas currently have introduced Enabling Good Lives. What areas are they?
Me. Well, I'll say Canterbury, Mid-Central, and the third one, I can't think. Who are they?
There's a Waikato.
Waikato, right.
Yes. Oh, well done. Question number two from the report. The annual spend on disability support services is A, $1 billion, B, $1.4 billion, C, $1.8 billion.
I'd fail on that one.
And I don't think it matters because we don't see it.
That's a very good point. And the money you're not seeing is $1.4 billion. My last question is about the Simpson Report itself, because I'm always interested in the dynamics of pieces of paper. How many pages are in the chapter on disability? The total report is 274 pages.
I think that from memory is about 12.
Oh, Jane, you're cutting them short. 21.
Oh, just turn that number around.
Thank you so much for taking part today. And we will be continuing to revisit different aspects of the system changes in our System Fix podcast. So keep listening and thank you and have a Merry Christmas.
Happy day. Thank you very much, Barbara.
Thank you for listening to this episode of System Fix. If you'd like to learn more about what's happening in the health sector, in particular in the primary care sector, you can subscribe to New Zealand Doctor Rata Aotearoa at nzdoctor.co.nz. Bye now.